I think we ought to get started. Looks like everyone's here, and we have a closing time, so we would like to get things going as much as possible. So let's begin. We're going to have an opening song, and after that, it's I'll Walk With You. It's page one in the handout. And then Mary Ellen Robertson has some announcements.
And I'm supposed to come over here and see.
Oh, all right. I should have announced Todd Compton on the violin.
Thank you. kind of underwriting is especially helpful because it allows us to spend less time worrying about covering the bills and more time focusing on the symposium program. So it's a quality booster all around. Thanks to all of those who have loaned us AV and other equipment, including Lisa Fahey, Connell O'Donovan, Richard Rands, Douglas Hunter, and Laura and Todd Compton, and I hope I haven't forgotten anybody. And a special thank you to Michael Stevens, who's the co-chair of the board, and our dedicated AV guru, who's been toiling in the background to get everything set up for our AV intensive sessions. It's a kind of thankless task, but essential if we want things to run smoothly. So
I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night.
So thank you for doing a thankless task. And we also want to thank Sunstone's office manager, Carol Quist, and her husband, Bill. They drove out here from Utah and schlepped magazines and supplies for us, so we didn't have to try to pack it in on the flight. And I also wanted to make a request. We handed out copies of these survey forms with your programs today, and we'd like to get your feedback on the sessions you particularly enjoyed, any comments you want to make about them. Tell us what we did well, tell us what we sucked at and could work on for next time, and tell us how often you come to these events. We'd really like to know, and any other feedback you have, because this is really valuable for us in learning what works, learning what doesn't work, and I'm still fairly new at this job, and so I can use all the feedback we can get. It doesn't have to be pleasant and smiley face. You can tell us how you really feel. It won't hurt my feelings. So I'll go ahead and let Morris take over and introduce our panelists, and we'll get going tonight. Thanks for being here.
Well, in 2000, 61% of the California voters approved a ballot measure, Proposition 22, that proclaimed only marriage between a man and a woman is valid and recognized in California. Support by the church, though mostly behind the scenes, was an important factor in the success of that proposition. 8 years later, on May 15, 2008, the California Supreme Court struck down the ban on same-sex marriage, declaring that the state constitution protects a fundamental right to marry that extends equally to same-sex couples. Soon thereafter, forces opposed to same-sex marriage qualified what would become California Proposition 8, which proposed a California constitutional ban, against same-sex marriages. On June 29, 2008, a letter from the First Presidency of the Church was read in all California congregations, which addressed the subject of same-sex marriage. It said, among other things, "The Church's teachings on this moral issue are unequivocal. Marriage between a man and a woman is ordained of God, and the formation of families is central to the Creator's plan for His children. Children are entitled to be born within the bonds of marriage. We ask that you do all you can to support the proposed constitutional amendment by donating of your means and time to assure that marriage in California is legally defined as being between a man and a woman. Our best efforts are required to preserve the sacred institution of marriage." Less than 2 weeks later, battle was joined when an article was published in Meridian Magazine, authored by a local leader of Prop 8 campaign, that was titled, "Wonder What the War in Heaven Was Like? Watch California this fall." The article compared those who opposed Prop 8 to Lucifer and his followers. Strangely, at least to some, was the article's explanation that the principles of fairness, of equal worth of God's children, of compassion and sympathy, and of logic were actually tools of the devil. This evening, we are favored to hear from a panel of five participants in the Battle of California, all of whom no doubt would be consigned by many to the ranks of Satan's minions. They are, and this is the order in which they'll speak, Lisa Fahey, who's from San Francisco. Lisa has a BA in graphic design from BYU and is employed at the Palo Alto Research Center. She's an active straight Mormon and an activist and freelance artist. She loves running half marathons and obviously has a sense of humor because when she raced at Disneyland, she dressed as Minnie Mouse. Now, I asked each of these people to kind of give me a little something in their bios that livened them up. Leland Chan, sitting to my right, is a native of San Francisco. He received a Bachelor of Science degree from BYU and a Juris Doctor from Berkeley. He's General Counsel of the California Bankers Association, in charge of litigation and regulatory affairs. Now, that's all Leland gave me, and frankly, that's boring. So I'm going to take take a page from the book that my wife and I authored, entitled "Breathe Life into Your Life Story." Copies available at Signature Books. And make a few things up. Leland, because that's the way you really breathe life. Leland is actually the great-grandson of the famous detective Charlie Chan. Little known that he was invited to try out for the Golden State Warriors as a power forward. However, he sprained his ankle and that seemed to doom his chances. He's married with 55 children. Okay. Kaimo Pono Wenger, whose name I can never pronounce, but that, I assure you, is the genuine Hawaiian pronunciation, is an assistant professor of law at Thomas Jefferson Law School in San Diego. He graduated from Columbia Law School, where he was a James Kent Scholar and a Harlan Fiske Stone Scholar. I don't know what those are, but I think they're a step up from a Bart Simpson scholar. After law school, Kaime clerked for a federal judge and then practiced law for 3 years with the Wall Street firm of Cravath, Swain & Moore in New York City. He's a founding blogger of more blogs than I've ever blogged on. And he's sometimes quoted on legal matters on TV shows and the newspapers. He's married, has 3 children, and currently serves as elders quorum teacher, choir pianist, and ward photographer. Laura Compton, a lifelong member of the church, who's alternatively known as Nadine's daughter, Todd's wife, Zachary's mom, she now goes by that Prop 8 lady. Laura has a bachelor's degree in journalism from Humboldt State. Prior to retiring from the paid work world to stay home and nurture her 2 boys, which of course enabled Todd to protect them, she worked as a newspaper reporter, a PR specialist, a legal secretary, and had personal adventures with both the ERA and the Prop 22 church campaigns. She spent much of the past year researching, recruiting, developing, and moderating content at MormonsForMarriage.com. And I can tell you, I have no idea how she managed to fit everything in that she does in her life. I think it's incredible. And finally, Clark Pingree is an unofficial gay LDS activist, advocating equal rights for the gay community. He's a graduate of BYU, served an honorable mission to British Columbia, and is a former MTC instructor. He came out of the closet almost 3 years ago after nearly a decade in silence, and has shown that when those closet doors swing open, they can swing widely and loudly. Clark was an active participant in the No on 8 campaign in California and has been a contributor to Mormons for Marriage and LDS homosexuality websites. Throughout the Prop 8 campaign, Clark spoke in various venues as an unapologetic, openly gay Mormon. Clark lives in Walnut Creek, California, loves traveling and skiing, in addition to microphones and soapboxes.
Some light should come down. So maybe
over there.
But then we're dark up here, though.
I know, so.
The other one.
That's
good. Is that good? Can you see or no?
Can you see the view?
That's good. You can do that. So in my ward, when you give a talk, you say good morning or good evening, and then everybody else responds back. So this makes me feel more comfortable because I'm very nervous. So good evening.
Good evening.
Oh, that was a good choice. Thank you. I'm a fifth or sixth generation Mormon, I'm not exactly sure. I'm active, straight, and recently released as second counselor in the Sacred Lake Society presidency. I'm most comfortable working behind the scenes and not in the spotlight. Why I got involved. In 1999, I was asked by my ward to help pass Prop 22. When this went against everything I'd ever heard about in, from the pulpit, that the church does not get involved in political issues, or, politically, but now claims an exception for moral issues. Going to someone's home for a secret meeting felt wrong. Having signs handed out in Relief Society felt wrong. Being asked for money felt wrong, and voting to discriminate against my gay brothers and sisters felt and feels really wrong. It all felt creepy, and I wanted to send a letter to my church asking them what in the world they thought they were doing. Instead, I was quiet. Thinking I was the only one who felt this way, all I did was vote no on Prop 22. When the church issued the letter to be read in church last June, regarding Prop 8, I could no longer only vote no. I had to do something. How I got involved. A series of fortunate events has taken place since Prop 22. I have new Mormon friends in and out of the ward who are well informed. I have a Facebook presence. I now live in San Francisco. Google sends me news alerts, and I'm on a few Mormon email distribution lists. From one of these lists, I received an email asking for volunteers to help with a website letting people know where the church, there were church members supporting marriage equality, and I said yes. I mostly work behind the scenes, as Laura Compton and others did the lion's share of the work on MormonsForMarriage.com. I wrote a few postings and asked Leland to post some commentary and asked Carolyn Pearson to share a chapter of her book on the website. Mormons for Marriage was just what I needed. I needed a community of people that felt like me. What happened next? An overwhelming desire to be vocal came over me, almost like it was my calling. Every day I read Mormon for Marriage comments. I signed up for Google Prop 8 news and blog alerts. I became a Prop 8 news junkie and avid Facebook user. I felt energized and excited, as well as exhausted and overloaded with information. I let my church leaders know what I was doing and was told nothing would happen to me. We only had one meeting in my ward about Prop 8, and it was during Sunday school. We were encouraged to say whatever was on our minds. This was a great and dreadful day. Dreadful because one brother spoke up and said, as a gay man, he was, quote, an abomination in the sight of God, and that homosexuality was the worst of all sins, end quote. Then to confirm his self-hatred, a handful of members clapped. I did not look to see who they were, as I did not want to hate them. It was a great day because I found out there were brave, like-minded members of my ward who had the courage to stand up in front of everyone and speak out loud. I was not always so brave. I'm really nervous, sorry. That great day, those of us who were in favor of marriage equality came together and formed a support group. Many of them are here today. We met and talked about Prop 8 several times, and we've become good friends. We wore vote no on 8 buttons and rainbow pins to church every week. We posted our views on Facebook. We went to phone banks and made calls and had spiritual experiences doing so. We donated money online to the No on 8 campaign. We fasted and prayed for Prop 8 to fail. During the satellite broadcast, we made signs and put them on our cars in the church parking lot and handed out flyers. We put our signs in our lawns and in our cars, and some spoke up in testimony meeting, Relief Society, priesthood, and Sunday school. When asked to be interviewed by Jennifer Dobner, an AP reporter, regarding Mormons for Marriage, I said yes. Being my first ever interview, I was so nervous. like, it's my first talk in Sensona. But Jennifer was sympathetic and easy to talk to. I told my story and experiences so far and expressed how hard it was being a minority voice at church. After the interview was over, I felt like I'd just been through an exceptionally good therapy session. Jennifer encouraged me to tell my family about the article, as it would be published nationwide. I sent an email to my family, and not what much was said right then, except a couple emails saying that I was going to go to hell and not to get any more of these kinds of messages, or send any more of these kinds of messages out. Another opportunity came about to be interviewed on KRLC for Mormons for Marriage. This experience with Laura Compton for 30 minutes on the air was exhilarating. The time flew by. I felt like I had even more courage to stand up and speak out. Members of the ward, for the most part, knew where I stood. I respected those who struggled with how to vote, asked me sincere questions, and were thoughtful of their decisions. I hopefully made it clear that I was not there to change their minds. I wanted Mormons, and especially non-Mormons, to know there were in fact active straight members of the church in favor of marriage equality, actual Mormons who were voting no on Prop 8. One of the consequences of speaking out was there were members asking that I be reprimanded in some way, excommunicated, or my temple recommend revoked. Sometimes these comments didn't bother me, but most of the time they did. I felt judged and despised. When Prop 8 passed, our ward was divided, and a member of the state presidency came to give us a talk on unity. In the middle of his excellent remarks, a few protesters showed up outside the building. I was actually really excited, and I told the people next to me, "I think we're being protested." After the meeting, I ran outside and talked to them, and letting people know there were people inside who were just as upset as they were by the church's influence on the passage of Prop 8. We hugged, I took their picture, and they gave me a white carnation. I felt happy and satisfied. I made friends, and they now knew that not all Mormons thought alike. I'm pretty sure my family thought I was one of those people protesting at temples and ward buildings, causing imaginary destruction and mayhem. Some family members wanted to talk to me and understand why I felt the way I did. I was really uncomfortable and nervous as they asked me questions and expressed their worry for my salvation. In the end, they also expressed their love, and I thanked them for worrying about me and told them that I wasn't worried about my salvation and that I loved them too. For the most part, I feel like a missionary or a goodwill ambassador for the church. I am thankful and humbled by this experience. I am a stronger person. I have learned to practice tolerance. I have respect and admiration for the gays and lesbians and the discrimination they feel. I've met some really amazing people on this journey. At the San Francisco protest and at the candlelight vigil where a small band of Mormons walked the same path as Harvey Milk, I felt like a celebrity as people shook my hand, hugged me, took my picture of my sign, and told me, thank you, thank you, thank you. I also want to say thank you as well to Laura Compton for helping me, or letting me be involved with Mormons for Marriage. Also thankful for Mormons for Marriage, for my ward support group. The very encouraging friends and not so encouraging friends, my coworkers, strangers, and of course my family who disagrees with me and still loves me. Lastly, I'd like to end with a quote by Bruce R. McConkie summarizing exactly how I feel about my involvement in Prop 8. This was read in Relief Society a couple weeks ago, for probably a different reason. But to be valiant in the testimony of Jesus is to take the Lord's side on every issue. It is to vote as he would vote. It is to think as he thinks, to believe what he believes, to say what he would say, and to do what he would do in the same situation. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I needed to change my presentation a little bit because when I came here, I didn't realize how liberal and way out in left field everybody is. I figured that I would go through some of the basics, you know. So I'll toss a few things out, and you can just speak forward a little bit. I was going to say that the church didn't really act, I think, appropriately after the vote, because they wanted to play the victim and say, hey, you know, we shouldn't be infringed upon, you know, exercising our freedom of speech. And this is not a freedom of speech issue. Freedom of speech means in the Constitution that the government shall not infringe upon the speech of individuals. The underlying policy of that is that society benefits when individuals in the private sector basically duke it out. And especially if you articulate very evocative ideas like homosexuals are second-class citizens, God does not approve of homosexuals, but we still love you. Those kind of things are provocative, and they should exact a provocative response. And I'm disappointed that this church has basically shrunk in a shell and played the indignant victim, saying, you know, we ought to have more civility, and da-da-da, the vote is over. So I think that the church will continue to be involved in these issues. I hope they do, because as much as I disagree with their position, I think that all members, all individual citizens and organizations ought to be part of this public dialogue. Of course, subject to laws and finance rules and so forth. So let's go on to the next point. Another point that's made, and I'd like to try to clear up, is the idea that the government should not redefine marriage. And I think my view as a lawyer is that marriage, this may be a cold description, but marriage is basically a bundle of rights and obligations. And marriage is a way for society to advance its universal goals, certain priorities that we all believe are priorities, without regard to religion. Dealing with things like division of ownership of property, duties to children, confidentiality privileges, visitation, tax benefits, divorce, inheritance. All these are very important issues that a government ought to be dealing with. And these rights and obligations apply whether you want to get married in a religious organization or not. It really doesn't matter. They're totally separate. And with all due respect to the church and any other religious organizations, the churches are not the ones that determine the parameters of a civil marriage. Because once you ask that question, then you have to ask the question, well, whose church ideals should we apply? If we apply the Catholic Church's ideals, then civil marriage will never have any divorces. And none of us, you know, goes into a marriage, if we do decide to marry, thinking that we will divorce. But the fact of the matter is, a plurality of us will. And to absolutely forbid it would be cruelty and not consistent with our ideals of liberty. So it is absolutely the province of government, and government should be tackling this, and not the church. Another idea that is bounced by the church is that tolerance goes both ways. Gays want to be accepted, but they also have to respect our religious beliefs. So I want to delve into that a little bit deeply. What rights do religious people have in terms of protecting their religious liberties? And so a good place to start is the Constitution, which says the Congress shall make, and this is the very first law, that very first principle that is articulated in the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And that's what we're talking about here, is the free exercise. And in America, it's very broad. We are free to attend any church we want. We are free to leave any church we want. It has not always been the case in America, as you probably know. If you were a Quaker in Boston in the 1600s, Anne Hutchinson was hung. Religious intolerance led Roger Williams to move out and establish his own colony in Rhode Island. And of course, today we see much religious intolerance, especially upon heretics in the Muslim world, for example. You just cannot leave. Things that we take pretty much for granted. And we have a freedom to believe in no religion as well, and the freedom to practice without government interference. Religious liberty actually goes well beyond that. Religious liberty actually promises believers that they can exercise their religion in ways that people who are not religious are bound to. For example, in the areas of mandatory education of children. There's a Supreme Court case, Wisconsin versus Yoder, regarding the Amish. The Amish did not want to comply with mandatory education for the children. They thought that 6 years of education was quite enough, otherwise you become vain before the eyes of God. And they were given an exception because of their religious beliefs. Liability for withholding medical treatment. Christian Scientists have been able to lobby over 40 states in this country that have laws that prosecute parents for not giving proper medical care to their children, but there's a religious exception for that. Military service, if you are a conscientious objector who can articulate a religious reason, not a sociological reason, not a political reason, but a religious reason, then you have the right of a conscientious objection status, and you can do some other service and so forth. Cruelty to the animals, the Santerians of Florida, there was a law that tried to pass to say that we will have no animal sacrifice, but that law was struck down because it interfered with their practices. And workplace discrimination, all these things religious liberty allows in this country because we respect religious liberty. But the marriage cases do not infringe upon religious liberty. The marriage cases would not require me to marry a gay man or prevent me from marrying a woman. So my religious liberties or any other liberties are not affected at all by the marriage cases. So I think that's an argument that we need to make whenever we hear that somebody's religious liberties are being affected. The next one, marriage between a man and a woman is ordained of God. And this goes beyond religious liberty because here, in the context of a proposition to limit somebody's right to get married, then religion is no longer viewed as a shield, but as a sword. And once you use religion as a sword, meaning that you will impose your views upon other people, then that presents great problems. If you can go back to the prior slide, Kim, it would be similar to the Amish saying not only that we will keep our children out of school after the age 12, but we will have a law that prohibits your children from going to school beyond the age 12, and a law pushed by the Christian Scientists to prohibit people from using any kind of medicine or treatment other than faith. This is the reaching out, and that comes square against the constitutional, the other provision of the Constitution, which is the Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. And this is the classic separation of church and state provision in the Constitution. What that says basically is that the secular government requires religious neutrality. It doesn't say that we have to have an atheistic society. It doesn't say that we have to be anti-God. It only says that in the United States, the Establishment Clause says we shall be neutral. We shall neither inhibit nor shall we promote any religion. We shall be neutral. And any kind of policy that we impose in society on all of us has to be articulated in terms of universal principles, not in sectarian tenets. So the argument for or against gay marriage must be based on evidence and on universal principles. This is a good thing, because if we don't have this limitation, that means that, for example, the Jehovah's Witnesses could push for laws preventing anybody from taking blood transfusions because of their beliefs in what Deuteronomy says. That is not an appropriate law to be pushing unless the Jehovah's Witnesses can actually put forth evidence to say that this is healthier. That is a valid argument, but the religious side of the argument is not correct. And then my other example is that Muslims, no matter how strongly they feel about garb, they cannot require women, as a matter of policy, to wear headscarves, nor men to grow beards. That is using their beliefs as a sword upon the rest of us. And yet, if we look at what the LDS Church has said in its arguments, mostly articulated in the Divine Institution of Marriage, which I think is plastered everywhere, this is their lead argument, they start off with these arguments. Marriage is sacred, is a sacred ordinance of God. After creating Adam and Eve, the Lord God pronounced them husband and wife. We don't need to denigrate these ideas, but not everybody believes in God. Not everybody believes in Adam and Eve. Even Mormons, some don't believe in Adam and Eve. So it's not something that we can articulate as a policy argument for implementing a ban. And the next statement. Okay, thank you. So I'm going to move forward to maybe the meat of it. When we make these arguments, it's like saying this. With respect to faith-based arguments against gay marriage, it comes down to this. Could I demand a non-Christian gay woman to forego a meaningful and fulfilling relationship with someone else she loves for the duration of her entire life, because I believe that by doing so, she would enjoy my view of the afterlife? And I think the answer ought to be no. I want to address one final question, and that is the idea that a handful of judges should not overturn the will of the majority. In the Divine Institution of Marriage, the Church makes several arguments about 44 states have passed legislation, a broad majority of courts have upheld traditional marriage. It's an interesting argument because normally the Church doesn't appeal to the popular sentiment in terms of moral issues. They usually say, stay away from the popular sentiment. Another interesting issue this raises is that, what happens if 20 years from now a majority of states actually support gay marriage? Then will the Church follow along? It is an interesting question. But the principle of equal protection does not rely on popularity. It is, in fact, intended to be counter-majoritarian. In this state, unfortunately, because of Prop 8 and because of the likelihood that the Supreme Court will support Prop 8, the principle of equal protection in California is dead, because any majority can vote away the rights of the minority, and that is no protection of equal protection. And I think that the Church, being a minority church, is only going to be adversely affected in the future. I have some other stuff, but I can save it for the question and answer. Thank you.
I don't have any nifty slides, so, and I've got boring legal remarks, so try to stay awake. Let's see, I'll start with a couple of caveats. Yes, thank you, light is good. I am just going to give a legal analysis. I realize that these issues touch on personal, ethical, spiritual issues, and other things. I'm not going to go into those, so the analysis I give is just going to be on the legal level. And I'm going to discuss a couple of areas of questions. So the first one is a simple question, but it's one that a lot of people don't really understand, so I'm going to go over, which is what exactly do the marriage case decision do? And of course, as Morris mentioned, the history of Proposition 22, we get in 2000, the ballot amendment, but the the proposition saying marriage, man and a woman. As a result, what we get is litigation from same-sex couples. There were several same-sex couples who were married. There was some question about whether this was legal or not. This was done in San Francisco. We get the Supreme Court invalidating that set of marriages, but saying we're going to rule on the question, a series of complicated legal maneuvers on this, ultimately coming down to the marriage cases decision last year. So, last year. What the marriage cases decision focused on was the California Constitution and the Equal Protection Clause in the California Constitution. Constitutional law in 20 seconds. Some people or certain classes of people get special protection, and you can't pass laws that disadvantage those classes of people without passing very high legal thresholds. So, that won't get you through a common law class, but it's enough for this discussion. What the California Supreme Court held was that sexual orientation is one of those protected categories. So laws that disadvantage people on the basis of sexual orientation have to show some sort of compelling justification, and this law hadn't done that. And as a result, because sexual orientation was a protected category, and because this law disadvantaged people on the basis of sexual orientation, it was struck down as invalid against the California Constitution. Interestingly, the argument was raised that same-sex couples in California do have a right to domestic partnership, which gives all of the same legal benefits as marriage. The California does have the best domestic partnership laws in the country, and the California Supreme Court, in a 4-3 decision, said that this was not sufficient. It still deprived people of some rights based on sexual orientation because of the reputational factors, in effect, which come out of marriage. So, as a result, same-sex couples were allowed to marry under the California Constitution. Of course, this led to the passage of Proposition 8, stating only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California. This was immediately challenged. So let's talk about oral argument for a minute because about the Proposition 8 challenge. Basically, three arguments have been brought up in the legal challenge against Proposition 8. The first is a revision versus amendment argument. That is that some changes to the Constitution are big changes, and they have to be made through a more complicated process. And there's very little case law on this. A one ballot amendment from decades ago, which changed 15 different sections of the Constitution, was too big to do through a simple majoritarian process. And another one, which purported to tie the hands of the California Supreme Court and not allow them to find constitutional criminal protections, was also invalidated. Those are the only cases that have been invalidated as being too large to be done through the majoritarian process. And that is that some changes are so big that you have to do more than just get a majority. The Constitution is supposed to protect at some point against majorities doing crazy things. So for these kinds of changes, you need a more complicated constitutional amendment process. And again, that's the very quick version. So that the argument raised is that Proposition 8 affects changes in the California Constitution that are large enough that they require a revision process rather than an amendment process. In addition, Jerry Brown, good old Governor Moonbeam, raised a completely wacky argument against Proposition 8, saying that it was not actually a revision, so it's not invalid based on that ground, but that because it takes away a fundamental right, it clashes with California Constitution's guarantee of fundamental rights, thus effectively arguing that part of the Constitution is unconstitutional. That's tough to do, but good old Moonbeam, he certainly made the argument. And finally, there was a big question about retroactivity. About 18,000 couples married in this interim period. There's a big question about whether or not those marriages would be held invalid or not going forward. So the case went to oral argument just a couple of weeks ago before the Supreme Court. We saw some very interesting analysis there. First off, the revision versus amendment did not look like the court is really on board with the idea that Proposition 8 is a revision and is therefore too big of a change to do through a simple ballot process. Justice Kennard, who was one of the four justice majority, seemed very, very dubious of this. Chief Justice George also seemed relatively dubious of it. I would not put the chances of the revision versus amendment argument succeeding at particularly high. Jerry Brown's Moonbeam argument was completely shot out of the water, and there's no chance at this point that the court will take that the one bright side for advocates of gay rights is that the court also seemed very dubious of retroactively striking down these marriages. Ken Starr on the other side made a novel argument saying this isn't actually retroactivity. This is just going forward. We're saying they're not valid from now on. So we're not saying they weren't ever valid. We're just saying they're not now, and that's not retroactive. It's an interesting semantic exercise, but the court did not seem to buy that one. And as a result, it looks like they're unlikely to accept the argument made by Ken Starr on a brief signed by Andrew Puna, LDS attorney, that that these marriages should be invalidated. The church did not make any statements that I'm aware of about retroactive invalidation at any point in time, though the fellows in the Protect Marriage Coalition certainly have. Other things that happened at oral argument, Ken Starr has a very broad vision of what people can do through the amendment process. The court asked, is there anything that stops him? And he said, eventually you hit the U.S. Constitution. As long as you're not doing something that's against the U.S. Constitution, it should be fine for a California majority to do it. They asked a question of the National Center for Lesbian Rights attorney, Shannon Minter, which is, what if you were passing the opposite? What if you're passing an amendment saying same-sex marriage is law or is allowed? Is that a big change? Is that a revision? That's a tough question. Shannon Minter tried to thread the needle and say both if a majority passed a law allowing same-sex marriage, it would not be so big that it would have to pass this higher hurdle. But since a majority passed a law removing same-sex marriage, that is so high that it has to pass the higher hurdle. The court did not seem to buy his argument at that point. That's a tough question. And it's a very relevant one because the way the demographics are going, it seems very likely that at some point in the next 4-8 years, there's going to be another amendment process and probably the reverse passed. What happens retroactively, Ken Starr said, use the putative spouse doctrine, which is an equitable doctrine for people who think that they're spouses but aren't because of some clerical error or something that allows them to get enough rights that they don't get deprived of rights, but they're not actually treated as spouses. So that's the solution suggested. The court seemed very skeptical of that. And finally, Justice Chin, who was one of the dissenters in the original decision, asked a couple of times, what if we strike down marriage altogether? What if we say no marriages at all in California? It's just civil unions for everybody, or just domestic partnership for everybody. The Proposition 8 opponents said that that is something the court would be empowered to do. Ken Starr said, no way, the court isn't allowed to do that. It's an interesting question because, in theory, Proposition 8 doesn't actually change most of the marriage cases. Marriage cases, remember, was a two-step process. First, sexual orientation is a protected category and thus gets higher constitutional protection. Second, therefore, it applies to marriage. Proposition 8 appears to just get rid of the second part, so sexual orientation is still a protected category in California. If that's true, one way to reconcile that would be to say no marriage for anybody, it's all civil unions for everybody. Justice Chin seemed to be pushing a little bit at that, which was a very interesting set of questions there. So we will know one way or the other within 3 months the California Supreme Court is going to come down on this. Remember, this is not just, a lot of people see this as a rehearing of marriage cases. This is not a rehearing of marriage cases. A couple of the attorneys, in effect, tried to re-argue marriage cases. The court did not want to hear that. What we're talking about is this the type of change that is so big that a majority can't make it? And that was the main issue that the court was going over in the appeal, the recent appeal. Let's talk about a couple of other things. Sorry, I'm going to go kind of quickly here. What rights are affected by marriage cases in Prop 8? The short answer is very little was changed by marriage cases and very little was changed by Prop 8. This is obviously there's a lot of rhetoric on both sides, but as I've mentioned, California has the best domestic partnership laws in the country. And in addition, the feds already didn't recognize the marriage because of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. So as a result, prior to marriage cases, what you have is domestic partnerships with the full right of marriage and no federal rights because federal rights didn't do it under DOMA. After marriage cases, you had marriage with the full rights of marriage, and again, no federal rights due to DOMA. After Prop 8, once again, we're back to there's essentially no legal change in the status of of couple rights in California. I realize there's a strong emotional, rhetorical amount of energy put in here, but there's very little. There's a tiny footnote in Marriage Case in which talks. There are 9 very, very tiny differences between the two, but they're essentially not issues. So as a result, statements to the contrary on both sides, statements from church leaders, which you may have heard, statements from others saying that if Prop 8 is not passed, the sky will fall. Those are, as a matter of law, Prop 8 really didn't do much. And on the flip side, people who have said, you know, Prop 8 is the end of equality, it's not. I mean, it's an unfortunate case for advocates of gay rights, but it is, at the end of the day, it has changed very little in the legal playing field. One interesting thing that may have a legal effect in the future is President Obama has talked about repealing DOMA. If DOMA gets repealed, then Proposition 8 matters as a legal matter. Until then, it effectively, I mean, this is a lot of heat and noise, but not a lot of actual legal effect. And again, I realize that it is an important emotional effect for people, many of whom I'm friends with, but there's not a lot of legal change going on here. And just very briefly to hit a couple of other things. Is the church allowed to get involved the way it was? The church is a tax-exempt organization under 501c3. What that means is that it cannot lobby for particular politicians, which it didn't here. It can't say vote for Laura Compton. And what it also can't do is it can't donate a substantial amount of its resources to lobbying. That is a totally fuzzy test. There's not a lot of law on that. The law on that suggests that if you're under certain thresholds, like 5 or 10%, then you're not giving a substantial amount. The church itself didn't actually give very much to Proposition 8. On the other hand, they used member lists and encouraged members to. I'm not actually a tax attorney myself, but a couple of friends of mine who do tax, and one tax professor at Florida State I've talked to, has a paper on it and says that the church is pretty well within its legal rights. There's some questions about whether this should be changed. I mean, clearly the law did not anticipate a sort of private mobilization. If the church itself had given $30 million, maybe that would be a substantial contribution. Just telling members to doesn't look like on the organizational level, at least according to tax people I've talked to. And if that is something which the IRS chooses to change, it's very unlikely that they would apply that retroactively. So it's very likely that the church's actions are fine according to tax law. Again, I'm not a tax attorney, but this is what I have been told in discussions with tax people. All right, and so, those are some of the legal issues, and if you have questions, I've got more, we'll do it in Q&A.
Obviously, we know that the church is involved. They have really tried in the past to make their involvement look like it's grassroots involvement. That is, historically, since the Equal Rights Amendment, that they have really tried to get members involved and get them going and say, look, and go write your legislature, and all of a sudden, legislators, assemblymen, senators are flooded with letters. And they have no idea where it came from. There's an example of this happened with the Pepperdine University, the first ad that was pro-Prop 8. Some of the alumni from Pepperdine wrote in and were upset that their school was being used as part of this approved Proposition 8, and they really castigated some of the folks that were there. As a result, the PR people in Southern California for the church sent out an email and said, hey guys, our folks are being really castigated by the alumni. Write in and tell them how much you support. Well, they got so many emails sent in to Pepperdine administrators that it shut down their email programs for a while. They had no idea what was going on. So they got word of the fact that this was a PR thing and that it was started by these grassroots people in Southern California, and lo and behold, they were able to contact the PR person for the church, the public affairs, the local public affairs person, and that public affairs person said, okay, folks, we did it. Stop sending emails. The email stopped. It was a miracle. So as we go through, I'll talk a little bit about the history. These are some of the key players that we have seen over and over and over again in this same-sex marriage amendment information. Lawrence C. Dunn, he was a member, Corps of the 70 back in Prop 22 days. Russell Ballard, as you all know, Neil A. Maxwell, Nellie Shokes, Richard B. Worthland, Lynn Wardle, he is a BYU professor at law. He was involved in some of the stuff in Hawaii and early on. Lawrence Research and Gary Lawrence, you're all familiar with Gary Lawrence. He was actually paid $3,500 for his company. Was paid $3,500 to do surveying with when Hawaii was going through its same-sex marriage questions back in 1996-97. Richard Worthland's research company also was involved in that, and actually was paid significant about 10 or 15 times more than that. Ken Starr, he has been involved. Go ahead and go to the next slide.
What about Lance Wickman?
Lance Wickman is another name that we hear very regularly. He was involved with Proposition 22, and I'm going to, at the end of this, this is a timeline that we put together. It's about 20 pages long, and so we're going to kind of go through some of the timeline stuff, and there's going to be some links here, and if the timeline is footnoted, in the interest of time, we probably won't spend a lot of time looking at the timeline points, but you're more than welcome to go to any of several websites that there will be on the slide listing later on. So just to compare, 4.6 million people voted yes on Proposition 22, and 4.9 million people voted no on Proposition 8. So if you look at the numbers, there are more people who voted against Proposition 8 than who voted for Prop 22. Various groups tried to get, ever since Proposition 22 passed, the lots of groups have been trying to get this constitutional amendment on the ballot, because they knew that as long as it was not part of the Constitution, it was going to be an issue. So they over and over and over and over and over again, every single time, there's like five or six proposed Proposition 8 wannabes. Even in this most recent election, when Proposition 8 passed, there was a similar amendment that was a similar proposition that was going through that would have stripped the domestic partnerships completely away. But that didn't get enough signatures, and Proposition 8 amendment did get enough signatures, so that went through. Go ahead and do the next one. This is a little bit of information about the donations to each of the campaigns. So you can see there were actually two committees that collected money for each proposition. In Proposition 22, the average donation for the Yes on 22 group, that was the group that the Mormons donated to primarily. The average donation on that was $451.08. The Protect Marriage Coalition, that's the one that Mormons donated to for Proposition 8, the average donation was $815.36. For the Defense of Marriage Committee in Prop 22, that was the smaller Prop 22 committee. A few Mormons donated to that, but mostly Mormons were donating to the other one. So that was $170. And then the National Organization for Marriage California had a higher average donation, but they had a lot fewer donors. They had a lot of institutional donors to that one. The medium amount is the amount that half of the donations were above that amount, and half the donations were below that amount. So you can see that the median in Prop 22 was a little bit higher than Prop 8. And then in all of them, the most commonly donated amount was $100. So in Prop 22, there were 9,200 donations, and in Prop 8, there were almost 46,000 donations to ProtectMarriage.com. When they first issued their donation report and submitted it to the Secretary of State, it knocked the Secretary of State's computers down, and it took them about 3 days to get that information up and published as per California law requirement. Go ahead. This is just, the next couple slides are going to show the differences between votes for Prop 22 and votes for Prop 8. So here we have in green the people who voted for Prop 22, and go ahead in the next one. this is the people who voted for Prop 8. The purple counties are the ones who voted against against Proposition 8. So it lost all along the coast. It lost in Los Angeles County. It lost in, I can't remember which those are, but they're up by Tahoe. Okay, the next Prop 22. This is the bigger the circle, the greater the margin of the difference between yes and no. So if you have a great big huge circle, now watch. This is Prop 22, now do Prop 8. So the difference is shifted a little bit. In some places, especially if you look in Southern California, there's the margin of error of victory is smaller. So go ahead to the next one. So timeline highlights. These are briefs in the in-ray marriage cases. This is who the church was involved with. The brief that the church wrote was on behalf of the LDS Church, the California Catholic Conference, the National Association of Evangelicals, and the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America. Kenneth Starr wrote that brief. I know that there was a little bit of confusion that came on immediately because we had the decision was made, and then the Proposition 8 was approved, and then the marriages became legal, and there was this question. So this just points out that in October 1st of 2007, that's when they started gathering signatures. It wasn't like, oh no, we just heard this marriage case in May, and all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, we have a proposition on the ballot. It's a long process. Let's go ahead to the next one. The Proposition A signatures had to be verified by the end of May. They were. The Archbishop of San Francisco, Archbishop Niederauer, he used to be the Archbishop in Salt Lake City, so he had good ties with President Hinckley, and back in December, he wrote a letter to the Catholics in the area, and he said, well, actually, back in May, I asked the Mormon Church to come, and I asked them because I heard from my Catholic Bishops' Conference, I really didn't know anything that much about Proposition 8, I didn't really know what was going on, but they told me that I should get the Mormon Church involved, so I did. But nobody heard about his invitation until after the election. In June, the church contributed its first $20,000 of donations that was in kind. They paid for legal services, and they reported that. Because of the way the reporting system worked, it was unclear to people who were just looking at donations online that this didn't show up until after the election. Online. It didn't show up till December. And so up until December, everybody's thinking, oh, the church just donated like $4,000 for a couple of flights back and forth. The reports were submitted on paper, and because of the way the reporting requirements work, that information did not have to be reported necessarily online. It was there, and once they met the threshold, then everything had to be reported online. Okay, go ahead, Kim. Whoops, two. Go back one. Push. Oh, yeah. So we had the first presidency letter read in June, at the end of June, and in early July we had a bunch of people who wanted to do something on the internet. The internet was abuzz for about a week before the letter was read. This kind of shows the telescoping of what's been happening with the church and its involvement in politics. And with the ERA, the church got involved fairly early on. But nobody really paid attention in the mainstream press for a few years. And with Hawaii, when the church was involved with the same-sex marriage in Hawaii, the church was involved but kind of kept it under wraps for almost a year. In Prop 22, the church got involved in May, and it didn't really hit the press until August, September. When Proposition came out, well, Proposition 8, when this letter came out, it was actually leaked to the internet before it was read in church. So you can see this telescoping that's happening, and that there's nothing done in secret anymore. It's shouted from the rooftops, just like the scripture says. there are several. I've listed a few of the websites that were created. We have Signing for Something, where a lot of you. That was I think it was probably the first one that came out, and that was where people were able to write. It's a play on President Hinckley standing for something, and it says. get up here and, you know, we don't like what you're doing. People were able to write letters, and the idea was that they were going to submit those letters to the Quorum of the Twelve First Presidency. LDS for Gay Marriage focused a lot on scriptural reasons why LDS should not be involved. Mormons for Marriage really wanted to do two things. It wanted to provide a community for people who, like Lisa and Leland and many of the others who felt like they were alone and isolated in their wards and in their communities. But even with just one person from each ward, that's about 2,000 people in California. We wanted to let people know that they weren't alone. And probably one of the very best comments that we ever got was this guy early on, he was blogging on his blog, and his title was, "I'm Not Alone." And it talked about how he had found this Mormons for Marriage site, and he had found comfort and peace in knowing that other people thought like him, and he could have a community there. Mormons for Marriage almost didn't get off the ground. One of the founders, I've kind of fallen into being the spokesperson for Mormons for Marriage because I've been in a very safe place ecclesiastically, and this is something that is highly important to me, and I wanted to speak out on. But one of the early founders of Mormons for Marriage, when we were discussing what we wanted to do, we said, "What are we going to do? We got to do something." And this person wrote an email because there are so many people involved and lots of people felt like this was a really, you know, tough issue and they didn't want to be public. So I'm not going to use names here unless people have actually given permission. So he said, "I become quite concerned about the very tepid support for my LDS friends, straight and gay, as I've been trying to advertise, promote, gain the support for this project as currently named Mormons for Marriage. Very tepid. Some and only some of my progressive Mormon friends are sympathetic to the LDS gay cause in theory, but very, very few are willing to do much actual work, let alone put their names behind something that would directly oppose the brethren on something like Prop 8. Even folks who are world champions for LDS homosexual issues are hesitant to back Mormons for Marriage with their name and full support, and I don't blame them." It was specifically because there are people who were afraid to speak up that I felt that I needed to speak up. And it was specifically because I knew people who were so affected by Proposition 22 and the outcome and how it hurt their families that people needed to know that they were not alone. And people needed to know that there was a community, and people needed to get some fact-checking. And as a result, we were able to put Mormons for Marriage up. We tried very hard to keep comments there safe and to keep people have the opportunity to express their feelings in a safe place and to ask questions in a safe place. And I won't have time for it, but I've saved some of the comments that didn't make it through moderation, and they were very, very fun. So if anybody wants to look at those slides afterwards, you're more welcome. So let's go on to the next one. This is the structure of how Proposition 8 was aligned. Our bishop early on knew how we felt about Proposition 8, but specifically wanted us to come to the training session, and he wanted us to be involved and to know what was going on. I don't know that he knew that I was going to be doing a Sunstone presentation on it, but he's not a bishop anymore anyway. So here's the ecclesiastic. There are two arms. They wanted to keep them separate, but as you can see down at the bottom level, the zip code supervisors, I have yet to hear of any zip code supervisors who were non-Mormons. There might have been some, but I have yet to hear of that. And all of the people who volunteered at protectmarriage.com volunteered and were assigned, because of where they lived, they were assigned to a zip code supervisor. The zip code supervisors reported to their regional directors on the grassroots arm, but they were all called by their bishops. So you can kind of see it's kind of squishy down the bottom, but this is the chain of command. Go ahead and keep going. Some more highlights. The Divine Institution of Marriage was released. That is an unsigned article. We have a pretty good idea who wrote it, but I haven't been able to confirm it from two sources, so I'm not going to tell you what I heard. But you would be interested. Keep watching it, Mormons for Marriage. When we get it confirmed, we'll put it up there. So there's some question about the Glenn Greener did 9 talking points. That was a signed article by Meridian Magazine. Shortly after thereafter, we had the six talking points, and it was variously attributed to Elder Lawrence and President Lawrence and Gary Lawrence, the pollster. And we had a Mormons for 8. Let me talk a little bit about that. That is our little website that tracked Mormon donations. And without that site, nobody would have known that all this surge of donations was coming from Mormons. When Proposition 22 happened, I looked back on the Secretary of State's website and realized, oh, here are these people. And oh my goodness, my former bishop donated $50,000 for Proposition 22, and his friends donated $8,000 more. I thought, well, gosh, I wonder if anybody I know is donating money to Proposition 8. So we looked on there, and I found a few people, like all of the people in who showed up on the donation slips that were in my stake in my former state, except for two people were Mormons. And so I said, gosh, I wonder if this is happening anywhere else. So I talked to some friends, and we mushed it around, and we thought, you know, this is probably news in Los Altos, California, that everybody except for one person who donated money to Proposition 8 is LDS. And so as it kind of got switched around, we sent out some feelers and decided that there needed to be a website up here that was Mormons for 8. And there were several people, again, who were involved with this website, and we were tracking the donations. And as you know, that word got out. And for good or for ill, people became aware that Mormons were asked to donate money. Now, there are Catholics were asked to donate money too, and that has not been publicized as much. A lot of questions at Mormons for 8 was, well, where's Jews for 8 and where's Catholics for 8? I'm like, well, you know, I'm not Catholic. They can write their own website. But there was one more famous one that came up is there's this ice cream parlor in Sacramento, and they donated, the family that owns that donated about $40,000, and they got boycotted, and the guy, the father said, well, I'm only donating this because my Catholic bishop told me that I really needed to donate and support this money, and please, what are you going to do? Well, the day of the boycott, they had so many Yes on 8 supporters there that it kind of, they had the best business of the day. So, you know, it goes both ways. The blacklists or whitelists, the whitelists or blacklists, and it kind of goes back and forth. Okay, we can go to the next one. Yeah. A few things. We had the satellite broadcast. We had ads. We had a couple of videos that were on Mormons for Marriage that were requested by their authors to remove them because their bishops asked them. They said, please take your videos down. And they talked about it, and they said, yeah, we want to keep our status in church. So they took those videos down. Go ahead to the next one. So there are protests. There was a complaint filed with the FPPC. Go ahead to the next one. We've got... This is where the timeline sites are. The easiest one to remember is Mormons for Marriage. And at Mormons for Marriage, we have links to all these other websites. So go ahead to the next one. These are all a bunch of the LDS property-related websites. We've kind of put this together to give an idea that the Internet is a community, and as it has become an interesting and important community. Go ahead to the next one. So memorable moderator codes. So the last one, the first one was... pretty typical. Yes, I'm Prop 8. It's what I believe. Equality and or fundamental rights have nothing to do with it. So we'll go ahead. Go really quick to the very last slide. And it talks about some of the things that are online right now that are going on. We've got a few petitions circulating right now. One of them is to take the word marriage out of all California law, replace it with domestic partnership. You can sign that. You can find somebody who's having that. The other petition is to repeal Proposition 8, and it specifically says, it fights a couple of the arguments. One specifically says that the amendment will not be interpreted to modify or change the curriculum in any school, and it clarifies that the initiative is not intended and shall not be interpreted to mandate or require clergy of any faith or church to perform a service or duty inconsistent with his or her faith. Each of these petitions needs just under 700,000 signatures by early to mid-August, and I think that there are people in attendance today who have petitions to sign. So if there are, they can stand up at the end, and we'll let Clark go and do his really cool thing.
It's
been really nice to be up here with my War in Heaven comrades. And I've decided that if I go to hell, I would rather spend my time with you than in heaven, where everyone thinks I'm only 9/10 of a person. It's also a pleasure to be here with the Sunstone crowd once again, and I'm honored to share my thoughts on Prop 8 as an LDS gay man. I continue to have a great appreciation for the Sunstone Foundation and its openness to discussing issues around homosexuality. Prop 8 has given me an opportunity to be a voice for those who are gay and LDS. Amidst some of the scarring experiences I lived through Prop 8, I was also given opportunities to be a voice in the crowd, speaking up in defense of my community against the ruthless tactics of the Yes on 8 campaign. Through my partnerships with the Contra Costa Times, ABC News, KGO, Good Morning America, Time Magazine, and my recent participation in two documentaries, I found contentment in guarding against the continued attacks against gay Americans. And of course, I will never forget the remarkable experience of speaking at National Protest Day from the steps of San Francisco City Hall. I found a calling to do my part to dispel the stereotypes that not all gay people dance naked in the streets at gay pride parades, nor are the lives of gay people consumed in nymphomania, drugs, and debauchery. We're not coming to recruit your children, and we're not out to destroy your marriage. And to Utah Senator Chris Butter's surprise, we're not the greatest threat to America. And to further disagree with Senator Butters, we're not the meanest Butters you've ever met. I must confess, however, I think he's probably the meanest-looking Mormon bishop I think I've ever met. I'm a pretty average guy who lives a pretty average life and has the same dreams as everybody else. The only difference between me and the next person is my orientation. In LDS circles, it seems the once limited attitude of open dialogue on homosexuality has been killed by Prop 8. The LDS Church continues to be persistent in their rhetoric on homosexuality, and as long as these myopic approaches continue, I will remain firm in reaffirming the truth about the realities of being gay and LDS. Tragically, the advancement of sanctified discrimination in California has left many gay Mormons feeling that they have no place in their family, their church, and in their society. And far too frequently, they resort to suicide as their only way to escape their troubling predicament. As long as churches continue to drive gay people into the dark depths of suicide, I will never be silent. During the Prop 8 campaign, I felt exploited, degraded, and abused by the Yes on 8 campaign, and I am certain others like me suffered from what seemed like never-ending scapegoating. I shudder to contemplate how many gay Mormons took their own lives during Prop 8 as a result of this ill treatment. I will never forget the evening of Tuesday, November 4th. I recall falling from high to low in a period of 60 minutes. Around 8 p.m., it was clear that President Obama had won the presidential election. What an awesome historical event for America. 1 hour later, the results from each one of the California counties began to roll in. Over the next 4 hours, I sank as it became more and more evident that the Yes on 8 campaign had won. By midnight, it looked likely to have passed. I went to bed in deep sadness and awoke by news that while Prop 8 was not yet final, it looked likely to have passed. What a dark day Wednesday, November 5th was. I took the day off work so I could have some time alone in my own home to work through my feelings of heartbreak. The devastation I felt that day will forever be seared in my memory. It was a day when my civil rights and my dignity were stripped from me. To add insult to injury, my own church, which I once would have given my life for, was the main culprit in the confiscation of my liberties. It was a day when America had overcome one form of discrimination and adopted a new form of socially acceptable discrimination. The LDS Church had achieved the impossible. They had injected their doctrine into the California state constitution. One of the most difficult experiences I had prior to the election was one October Saturday morning when I was running errands in Danville. At a busy intersection, I passed by 50 people, seemingly members of the LDS Church, standing on the street corner with a 20-foot-long Yes on 8 Protect Marriage banner. They were standing in the pouring rain, drenched, waving, and smiling. This display was not surprising to me as during the weeks leading up to the election, the Bay Area seemed to be flooded in a sea of Yes on 8 campaign signs, billboards, TV ads, and radio ads, all saturated with fear and factual inaccuracies designed to scare people into voting Yes on 8. What shook me to the core of this scene was the line of children assembled standing in front of the adults. These children, all under the age of 10 mostly, were lined up parallel in front of the adults facing the street, holding a large banner sign that read, "Protect the Children." As I had a near emotional meltdown from witnessing this kind of setup, I wanted to stop and ask each one of these adults one by one, "Protect the children from what? From me?" Such extremes taken by members of the church and by the Yes on A campaign were so emotionally exhausting on so many levels that oftentimes all I wanted was for the election to be over, regardless of the outcome. I wanted all the demonization of gay people bombarding the airwaves, the TV, the streets, and the public squares to cease. I also recall Wednesday, October 8th, when the church organized a special satellite broadcast from Salt Lake City to LDS wards and stakes throughout the western United States, administering tactical instruction on how to get people in California to vote yes on 8. I was deeply disturbed by one statement from Russell Ballard of the Quorum of the Twelve, who declared, quote, "The power of the Spirit will be there to help us in our work, defending the kingdom of God and strengthening the work of the Lord Jesus Christ," close quote. If the work of the Lord is to take basic human rights away from minority groups and write discrimination into state constitutions, then I am eternally grateful that I know a God who would never endorse such an operation. Furthermore, during the broadcast, Elder Whitney Clayton of the 70 said, quote, "As a church, we do not get involved in supporting candidates or political parties, but when there are moral issues, the First Presidency has always felt it's important for our members to stand up and support those that are significant to the gospel of Jesus Christ and to the restored church," close quote. Imposing one church's definition of morality upon an entire society violates everyone's freedom of religion. There are thousands of moral issues in today's society with much greater impact than gay marriage. Using this rationale of defending a moral issue, I pose the following questions. What did the church do to stop genocide in Darfur? How did the church put a stop to torture at Guantanamo Bay? Where was the church when hundreds of Palestinians and Israelis were recently killed in the Gaza Strip? What did the church do to prevent the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which sent an entire world economy into a death spiral? What legislation did the church advocate for to prevent Bernie Madoff from stealing over $50 billion, leaving millions of Americans economically destroyed and the American dream in shambles? I find it curious that the church views gay marriage as a greater threat than these atrocities. And speaking out against, quote, alternative marriage, Russell Nelson of the Quorum of the Twelve stated that same-sex marriage is, quote, cunningly crafted by the adversary. Beware of his options, they always breed misery, close quote. I've lived through some pretty miserable times in my life, most of which were while I was trying to live the prescribed path of the LDS Church, consisting of self-denial, self-hatred, and self-disloyalty. Conversely, some of the happiest times of my life have come from being happy with who I am, accepting who my Creator intended me to be, and living a life that I believe God wants me to live. I have a clear conscience in this pursuit. I can literally say that Prop 8 has been and continues to be one of the most challenging experiences of my life. No other experience has tested my character more than Prop 8. No other experience has manifested more personal victories or more personal failures. No other experience has taught me just how hard it is to be a Christian. No other experience has given me a greater respect for the golden rule, "Do unto others as you would have others do unto you." Despite my hardships with Prop 8, I learned one earth-moving lesson. never lose hope. Hope is what got me through the hard times leading up to the election. Hope is what got me through the days following the election. And hope is what continues to sustain me in the healing process and the aftermath. Hope is how I've reconciled my faith. Hope is what is helping me find the strength to forgive, despite the very difficult time I'm having with forgiving. Hope came to America on November 4th when President Obama was elected. And a new form of hope had to be born on that same day, as gay people across the country felt the tangible slap in the face called Prop 8. Hope is how we will survive, overcome, and win this war for equality. Hope is how we will show our America our dreams, our virtues, and our intents are pure. When I think of hope, I'm reminded of that awesome National Protest Day. I will never forget the positive energy that prevailed at that rally on November 8th. Speaking before a crowd of 7,500 people, I expressed my sadness of the outcome of Prop 8 as a gay Mormon. I shared a message of hope and felt a powerful energy of hope reciprocated back from the crowd. I was especially moved by the hope offered from Baptist Reverend Amos Brown, president of the San Francisco NAACP. Addressing the audience of members of the human family, Reverend Brown stated, quote, "Though I'm a heterosexual, and though for historical reasons in my particular faith, we do not support same-sex marriages, I say unto you, though I am a Baptist, I refuse to be a bigot." Close quote. He went on to remind the crowd that, quote, "We live in a nation where the Bill of Rights allows us freedom from religion." Close quote. He then equated an experience he had earlier in his life, quote, "In 1955, at the age of 15 in Mississippi, I saw the mutilated body of a black boy named Emmett Till, who had been beaten almost into a pulp by some white racist. And when I saw that image, I said, if God let me live, I would never be mean to someone because they are different." Close quote. The hope from National Protest Day gave me a renewed feeling of optimism for the cause of me and my community. It couldn't have come at a better time, a time when over the previous few days, I had felt as if I had been knifed in the back, thrown in the ditch, and left in the wilderness at the hands of my church and my society. Today, many are looking to the California Supreme Court to overturn Prop 8. Personally, I believe that Prop 8 will not be overturned by the court. Yet this does not dash my hope. I firmly believe that we as a gay community have much work to do in telling our stories. We must rise above the injustice called Prop 8 and open up constructive, thought-provoking dialogue with our friends and our foes. We must tell our stories. Those in opposition to us are strong in their convictions, and we must be too. For too long, we've looked to the courts to solve our problems. I believe this has empowered the right wing in their sordid tactics of fear-mongering and misconstruing the truth on homosexuality. We as a gay community need to curb this propaganda and make our side of the story heard. People must know we hurt when the right wing dehumanizes us. We are loving, moral, and respectable characters in a mainstream society. And it's high time the rest of society hear what our lives are like as second-class citizens. With a slim margin of 52 to 48, there is no doubt in my mind that the will of the people will soon overturn Prop 8. What a wonderful day this will be for liberty, freedom, and justice for all. Once the will of the people have spoken against this self-justified prejudice, the tactics of the right wing to spread homophobia will wither away. I look forward to this day, and I believe this day is sooner than we expect. Hope helped me realize the unconditional love my mom and dad have for me. I found renewed hope from the love and support offered to me by my brother Dan throughout the hard times of Prop 8. Dan lovingly accepted the role of sounding board that I forced upon him. He endured my endless venting, and I will always love him for that. This unconditional family love gives me hope that every member of the human family has the ability to love all people, regardless of difference. Sadly, I've lost hope that the LDS Church will come around and extend a genuine loving hand to those who are gay and LDS. The events leading up to and following Prop 8 have proven the church's apathy towards homosexuals. Time and time again, the church has politically postured itself, attempting to speak words of compassion towards homosexuals, followed by actions that prove to the contrary. I'm reminded of Christ's admonition, "By their fruits ye shall know them." I do, however, hope that we will all be well one day in obtaining justice for gay Americans. The battle wages on, with almost every battle being won by the right wing and by the churches. With each lost battle, every gay person in America is once again kicked in the face. But we'll simply pick ourselves up and continue to fight on. I have no doubt in my mind that although we continue to lose most of these battles, we will eventually win the war. Truth cannot be stamped out, and history is on our side. One by one, with each coming out story, and as more lives are impacted by gay and lesbian friends and family members, Americans, and perhaps maybe even members of the LDS Church, will one day realize that, yes, it's even bad to discriminate against gay people, too. There will inevitably come a day when my grandchildren and my children will ask, "What was the big deal?" Thank you.
Well, we do have time for some questions. We get it given a little dispensation here. I'd like to ask you to try to keep them brief, because I will be repeating them for the recording, and I don't have a long memory. Yes?
This is not a question. It's just a comment to give Clark some hope. I drove my children to school one day. My 10-year-old daughter saw signs outside the local meeting house saying yes on Prop 8. I had never explained anything about Prop 8 to my kids. So I told her what it was about, briefly, the arguments pro and con. President Monson had said we should support it, and that we had our freedom to choose what to do. She thought for a minute, and she said, "Daddy, how does two guys getting married hurt someone else's marriage?" I said, "Well, what do you think?" She said, "I don't think it hurts it at all. I think you should be able to marry if you want." So,
that's great. Thank you.
Yes.
I think both Amy and there was another that mentioned the what you were saying, Amy, that the Prop 8 really didn't change anything legally, but the equal protection under the law clause has been gutted.
So the question, just for the listeners on the recording, is: didn't the equal protection under the law be gutted by Prop 8?
I realize that Prop 8 has an important symbolic impact. As far as legal protections, can registered domestic partners pass marital property to their spouses? Do they get intestacy rights? Do they get visitation rights? Do they get marital survival rights? Equal protection under the law is, and I realize, the label is important, but the legal protections granted are the same for domestic. Let me read the statute. Just to be clear about what the domestic partnership statute in California says, California Family Code Section 297.5, registered domestic partners shall have the same rights, protections, and benefits, shall be subject to the same responsibilities, obligations, and duties under law, whether they derive from statutes, administrative regulations, court rules, etc., as are granted to and imposed upon spouses. The legal rights are same. I realize there are emotional and symbolic issues that are attached, but the legal rights really have not changed.
Yeah, strictly within California, and we're talking about only California law, I think that's correct. The practicality, though, is that in the many, many areas of federal law, including the ability to have benefits payments to pay to your spouse when they die, and anytime you leave California, it's just not the same. And so it's pretty substantial if you're talking about trying to petition for somebody to immigrate to America that you want to marry. There's a whole slew of things that if you're a state in California, you'll only be subject to the denial of federal issues. But outside of California, you're basically unmarried.
If I can just...
There's altogether too many lawyers up here. Go ahead.
Yes. The problem, and I realize, Evan Wolfson has a great book, Why Marriage Matters. Take a look at it. 1,200 rights. The problem is that even after marriage cases, because of DOMA, if you were a married couple in California, you still didn't get marital rights outside of California or under federal law. So marriage cases didn't change that. What you would have to do to change that would be to get rid of DOMA. And so as a result, again, what happened was it didn't really change things, because if you were married in California during the interim period and you went to Idaho or Utah with your California marriage, under DOMA they would not be required to grant marital rights. This is what the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, and under federal law, you wouldn't get immigration rights, you wouldn't get Social Security rights. So definitely take a look at Evan Wolfson's book, Why Marriage Matters. But because of DOMA, state law marriage didn't really change the legal playing field.
Okay, and because I'm a lawyer, I have to weigh in here. the problem that the church, I think, was concerned about it was the slippery slope idea that if California fell to a equal protection argument, that other states could fall as well. And so I really think the battle here that most Californians donated their time and means for was not for California. California has already lost to the church. It's for the other states. Yes.
Sorry, I have a legal question. One of the arguments procedurally was that under California, the procedure allows the majority to make a change to the Constitution. And so here you have a constitutional change that's in conflict with an already existing constitutional equal protection concept. But what if the electorate, by majority vote, voted to remove voting rights from blacks? I guess that would conflict with the U.S. Constitution. But isn't there some other scenario you could paint where it wouldn't create a federal violation, but in which the majority could take away a, quote, constitutional right on the state level that would be essentially the same as what we're talking about here?
Well, let me just say, even taking away the voting rights to blacks, we had that on a federal level, didn't we? We had a constitution, and we denied blacks the right to vote. So, from my standpoint, the Constitution can be whatever the people say it should be. That's why it should be more difficult to change than California's current.
Right. Yeah, it is really interesting that California can change its constitution as quickly as it can. The U.S. Constitution, you have to go through a bunch of hoops. A couple of quick points. Constitutional amendments generally do change the prior structure. So, the argument made that this is inconsistent with prior structure is hard to make because, the 21st Amendment is inconsistent with the 18th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, prohibition or no prohibition. You say that the later amendment changes the prior structure. So saying it's inconsistent with prior structure is really hard to make when it's framed as an amendment. How much can they take away? This is what the California Supreme Court justices asked Ken Starr. He said the only backstop is the U.S. Constitution, so it would stop you if you tried to take rights away from blacks. If you had a group that is not protected under the U.S. Constitution, for example, if you said quintuple taxes on married people because we don't like marriage, presumably if you pass that under the California Constitution, you don't have a U.S. federal constitutional protection, you could do that. At least under Kent Starr's theory.
I'm hoping someone has a non-legal question.
Well, it is, but it's more progressive, I think.
Okay. In other words, yours is
so
more
what
interesting.
We can do? What can we do to overcome DOMA? And why hasn't that been taken up on a Supreme Court level yet? Because that's obviously unconstitutional. I'm blown away that was even put in place, really.
I think that there's great concern about taking it up in front of the Supreme Court as currently constituted. perhaps in another 20 years, it might not be so much.
But no time in the
well, there's a lot of very conservative justices that were appointed by George W. Bush, and they now control the court. And the ones that are about to retire are the ones that were appointed by his predecessors, and they're the ones that, if you're in favor of repealing DOMA, you don't want off the court. That's the problem. Anyone else have any different views on that?
Obama has said he's going to repeal DOMA, but it's apparently pretty low on the list.
Yeah, you'll see it.
He's got to save AIG for now. Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe Laura or whoever, just on the political side, is there a sense of having another battle so soon after this? Is that better to overturn it, or is it better to wait some time to let things cool off and let more parts change over 48 years? I'm just wondering I know it wouldn't be a preference, but what would be the most realistic?
I'll say a little bit. The people who are against non-aid are keeping it in the public eye. If you haven't noticed yet, if you still have Google searches going on, if you have your Google Reader turned on to Prop 8, it comes up every day. There's something going on. And the quality organizations have really made an effort to present to the public, and this is one of the things that we found with Mormons for Marriage, is that if you know somebody who is a normal, quote, person, who's in regular life, they work with you, they take their kids to the park, they are your brother's best friend, if you know somebody who's gay and you have a positive experience with that person, you're less likely to deny them marital rights. And so that's one of the prongs that I've seen, and Clark might be able to talk a little bit more about that. That people are really trying to say, look, we are human beings, we have feelings, we have normal people, and we are not necessarily the stereotypical gay pride people that you're afraid of. And I think that by keeping that up in the air, keeping that in the forefront of publicity, that's one of the reasons why people are starting to we want to hit while the iron's hot. People are feeling bad. There have been changes in polls, and people who voted yes on Prop 8, they've looked at it, and there's been a shift. And the margin of error is still, it's close, but there has been a shift that some people think, gosh, maybe I was wrong voting the way I did. But
My thought is the No on Aid campaign, I think, was very complacent. I think they grossly underestimated the force to be reckoned with, and that is the LDS Church is probably the most organized institution in the world. And no one can out-organize the church when they decide they want to accomplish something. So I think next time around, the No on 8 campaign will definitely be more awake of the switch. Secondly, I think the Yes on 8 campaign was pretty supercharged. And I think one of the few benefits to a tanking economy is if our economy is still in the tank in 2 years, how many people are going to get sick and tired of being asked to drain their kids' college funds that don't have anything left anyways to keep up this gay marriage rhetoric? I'm guessing that members of the church will continue to follow the prophet and continue to obey, but outside of the church, I wonder if people will get sick and tired of that. And at 52-48, that's really close.
The other option, too, is how involved is the church going to be in 2 years? Mm-hmm. We've had Prop 8 every Sunday for 3 hours in some wards. And in other words, they read one letter. So, if the church has really felt this sting of bad publicity, maybe in 2 years they'll get involved, but maybe not to the same amount of pressure. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say.
Yeah.
It's also possible, and I think we shouldn't underestimate the fact that the new version of this specifically is trying to take out of the mix the idea that kids will be taught about gay marriage in schools, which is a real flashpoint. It was a red herring, but that's what they grabbed onto. And the other one, slipped my mind right now, with the
marrying,
other
being forced to marry.
Oh, yeah, religions.
Preachers being forced to marry gay couples in the temple. That was a big one. So that's been taken out of the mix, presumably.
You think they'll put the temple on the ballot?
I'm not sure. You had your hand for a while.
Well, I just wanted to address this question because I've attended leadership meetings with the faith community nationwide and statewide, and I can tell you that at these meetings that there's a lot of ambivalence expressed about having something on the ballot for 2010. And that there's also the idea that we are in a dramatic restructuring right now. We're going to be turning away from the civil rights type discourse, but we're not sure what we're turning towards. So there's a lot of reorganizing and reconceptualizing going on the religious left right now and how to just talk about these issues. So my sense from attending these meetings is that we don't have enough time for 2010. You know, that if we're going to get something proactive going, there's just not enough calendar.
But the Mormons did it in 2 months. Come on!
But we have to. But the NOAA folks now realize that there needs to be a lot of rebranding of the message.
Well, I think and learning from the one thing, and we can all agree, the church is great at mobilizing people. Look at any flood. Look at any earthquake. That is one of the strengths. And I think, and as has been pointed out, the people who were on the NOAA side had no idea that that was happening. Now they know, and now they're able to try and figure out how to do something similar and how to counteract that quick mobilization. I mean, to have a war list with home teachers and visiting teachers, and you just pick up and make 3 phone calls, and all of a sudden you've got 5,000 people showing up with sandbags. You know, it's something that it's a plus, and anybody who's a politician would love to be able to have that kind of grassroots support. So
I think it may also be a question of whether you can stop a train. I mean, there may be a bunch of people who think it's not wise to go forward next year. I'm kind of on that fence a little bit. But then there may be others that do, and then you can't stop it. But there's a question in the back there.
Comment and a question. It's interesting that Emerson Ballard left a loophole about the church's position on gays when he was interviewed on Nightline by Ted Koppel in 1994. Ted Koppel asked him the two hard questions, what about gays and what about women? And when he asked Emerson Ballard about the women question, will women ever have the priesthood, Emerson Ballard said no. And he illustrated with his hands, he was making this gesture, which was kind of funny, it's like, this is their place. He said, no, Lord, you confirm, there's never going to be any change on this issue, and this is how he was talking. And then Ted Koppel said, well, what about gays in the church? And he said, well, we don't really know. There can always be a revelation. And I was fascinated that he left this... Okay. You know, women, no. Gays, no. So, you know, if the words were to one of the brethren to sort of, you know, open up and have a revelation about it, there might be hope there.
I have a question,
because I want you guys to respond to both of these, okay? The question is, has anybody done a poll or a survey of California Mormons to get a statistical sampling that would counteract the propaganda, showing that perhaps the silent majority of Mormons are in favor of gay marriage and not against it. And I would like to see somebody do, you know, what, through a university or a newspaper or somebody. Has anybody done that? I mean, that would be very helpful, I think.
The church could put a stop to that very quickly. Probably would.
This is the age of the internet. You know, Laura could organize the
it would not be scientifically valid.
It could be written off right away.
I would suggest that would be extremely helpful in counteracting the problem.
I would suspect that the Mormons who I think that they are representative of the communities where they are. So the Mormons in San Francisco are probably less supportive of Prop 8. The Mormons in Orange County are probably more supportive of Prop 8. And that's just the result of where they are in the mix. That would be my guess.
Stop it. Two thoughts. First, I think women will get the priesthood before gays are ever given the right to be in the church. Because doctrinally, I think it's a lot easier for the church to navigate around giving women the priesthood. I think homosexuality does not function well in the deep doctrines of the LDS Church. So I think it's a very, very long ways off. What was your second thought was? The polling. Okay, so one thing I found very, very fascinating with people that I was close to who know my story and who knew how much I struggled with Prop 8 and who I had very, very tough conversations with and very, very sincere heart-to-hearts still voted yes. And they didn't vote yes because of me. They voted yes because the prophet spoke and the prophet knows more than I do. In their view, and I received, you know, condolences from people who are close to me saying I'm sorry the Prop 8 passed, who supported it. So it creates when with this whole follow the prophet doctrine, I found it was actually very, very troubling because it really supersedes any sort of sincere dialogue. It almost makes members of the church the last frontier that will ever come around towards supporting gay marriage. And people would say, I know that what I did hurt you, but the prophet spoke. And it's very, you know, it made my head spin. But that's what you're dealing with.
The comments of Mormons for Marriage echoed that completely.
Let me say something here. Because I'm a big proponent of meetings ending when they're supposed to end. So what I'm going to do is call this at an end. We're going to have a closing prayer. And then I'm certainly willing, I'm sure everyone else is, to stay around. So if you want to sit here and ask questions and have kick it around, feel free to do that until they actually physically run us out of here. Mary Ellen, is it okay to skip the closing song, or shall we not?
Let's sing.
Okay, sing. Can we sing two verses?
We will sing two verses.
Oh, there you go.
Can I negotiate that?
Yes. Okay.
So two verses.
One and three.
Yeah, one and two. We need to clear out of this room. So if we're doing more talking after the session, please go into the lobby and hang out there and chat with
And Kim McCall will give the closing prayer. Are we negotiating the beginning note?
No, I've decided on the beginning note. We're negotiating verse 3 versus verse 4 for the second verse that we're going to sing. Verse 4 is a more modern one, but it's got hallelujah, and it has a very hopeful ending, and we're going to do that one. All right.
So
1 and 4.
No, well, that's... Wait a minute.
That's my G.
That's too uncertain for my taste. That's the G. That's the pretzel where it happens.
Dear Heavenly Father, we're so grateful for this day of of rejoicing, of consolation, of communion, of brotherhood and sisterhood that so many of us have had this chance to enjoy. We're grateful to all of our brothers and sisters here who've come to share their understandings, their experiences, their trials, and their joys. We're thankful for this evening, for the tremendous sacrifices that so many have made to defend the people they love, to venture out and share their understandings with those around them, and for the consolation they found in each other's presence. And we pray as a group of brothers and sisters for thy spirit to be a healing influence on the church, on all those who struggled and all those who need to hear a voice of reconciliation, a voice of conscience, a voice of love. We're thankful for the example that these people have set for us, and we pray that that would strengthen us all in having more of the mind of Christ and living as he would live. I say this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.
Great as usual.
You do
a very well, very good job.
Thanks for appreciate hosting.
Yeah. I know there's a lot of preparation that goes into getting something like that, because I tend to do the same thing.
Yeah, this one is all the I had to do it in.